Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you go to the events page. We've got a great event coming up in April. It's a regional event in Bentonville, Arkansas. You want to come and hang out with us for sure. It's going to be a good time. It was a blast last year. It was so good that we decided we're doing it again. So come hang out with Chad and me and Eric and Scott and Kelsey Klimbara and Caleb Keith and Andy Gullihorn is going to be there with his wife Jill Phillips. That's worth coming to just for that. You can come and hear me blather on for about 30 minutes or something like that. Then afterwards, you can hear Andy and Jill put on a concert and Bentonville Brewing Company providing the beer. It's all included in your $99 ticket price for the two-day event. It's a good time, so make sure you go over there and register. We'd love to see you there. Chad, we are in 1 Kings chapter 7. We got a temple built. Solomon's got a whole neighborhood built for himself, so that's nice. But now we're going to sort of go back to the temple after hearing about the Solomon's, you know, suburb. And we're going to see exactly, you know, what all is going to go inside of this temple. And we're going to hear about some furnishings. And, you know, this is probably one of those texts, if you're, you know, doing your read through the Bible in a year plan, you're starting to read this, you're like, this is a little dry.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. This is not people's typical favorite part of Scripture. Just because there's a lot of details here, a lot of architectural details. You know, people skim over genealogies, and they tend to skim over these details as well. And I totally get that. So we're not going to spend a lot of time in the weeds, as it were. We're going to highlight a few of the details, because there are some significant details, such as the fact that two pillars have actually names. You know, why were they named? Why would you put people's names on these pillars? We'll talk about that. Talk about a few of the details about what was on them. And of course, the main character in this particular section is somebody that seems like we met him before, but we actually haven't. A guy named Hiram. So we'll talk about him. This is a pretty long chapter. 1 Kings 7 is 51 verses. And we've covered the first 12 verses, which was the neighborhood, the suburb Solomon built for himself. Picking up with verse 13 through 51, we're going to hear about Hiram. We're going to hear about these pillars in front of the temple. Hear about the bronze sea, a bunch of smaller water basins. And then we'll hear about some of the details of the furnishings inside the temple. So anyway, it's a pretty interesting stuff to get to, just because of the symbolism of a lot of these furnishings and the names that were given to them. So starting out here, verse 13, 1 Kings 7, 13, King Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre. Now, we've already heard about Hiram a couple chapters ago. He's the king of Tyre. So our first thought is, oh, wow, so he's brought a foreign king to Jerusalem. Well, they do have the same name, but these are two different guys. So this Hiram is from Tyre, but he is the son of a, in the next verse, he's described as a son of a widow of the tribe of Naphtali. And his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. So this guy is probably, there's a couple different ways you can take this, but probably half Israelite and half Tyrian. I say a couple different ways because it's entirely possible, probably not probable, but possible that Hiram was the offspring of this widow's first husband. In that case, he would be full Israelite. And then the man from Tyre would be his stepfather. That's possible, but I think it's more probable that this Israelite woman from the tribe of Naphtali, she was widowed, and then she remarried this guy from Tyre, and then she had this son with him, who was named the same name as the king had. Now, I think it's important because I think it's important that he has the same name as the king of Tyre, because he is going to bring, as it were, the symbolism of this Gentile kingdom to Israel. He's going to be the one who's going to be doing all the work of bronze in the temple. And I'll talk as we go along more about why that's important. The next thing I want to point out about him is that he is described as full of wisdom, understanding, and skill for making any work in bronze. Now, the reason that's important is because if you go back to the book of Exodus and you read all about the construction of the tabernacle, which was kind of like the, you know, the portable temple, there was another guy who had basically this same role that Hiram has. His name was Bezalel. And if you go to Exodus 31, 1 through 5, God says to Moses that he has filled with the Spirit of God a guy named Bezalel, and he's given him ability and intelligence, knowledge and craftsmanship to devise artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, and cutting stones and carving wood, to work every craft. So just like the tabernacle had its Spirit-filled Bezalel to do all this kind of stuff, so now the temple has Hiram. And he's never described as full of the Spirit, but he is described in basically the same sort of way. So this guy's got, he's wise, he's understanding, he's skillful, he's learned this trade from his Turanian father. And so he's going to be the one that Solomon brings in order to make all this bronze stuff, bronze pillars, bronze sea for holding water, the bronze basins, all the various utensils that are going to be needed at the temple. So that's why we're introduced to him and why Solomon brings him in. Now, we're first of all told about these two pillars that he makes. This is verse 15. He casts two pillars. So these things are immense. They're 18 cubits high. So a cubit's about a foot and a half. So we're looking at about 27 feet high. And there's going to be two of them. And there's a lot of details if you follow along in the Bible. Verse 15 through 22 describes all, you know, the thickness of them and their capitals, how big they were, what they look like. But the only thing I want to point out here as far as what they did look like is that they had kind of a checker work or a lattice work on them. They had pomegranates at the tops on the capitals. And the purpose of these is to kind of frame the entrance to the temple. So when you're walking up, just like if you were to approach the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve were kicked out, you had these two cherubim that were guarding the entrance to it. So these are kind of like the guards, if you will. They're stationed there at the entrance to the temple. And they're made to kind of have this garden-like appeal, like we talked about in the last episode. Everything at the temple is intended to be an architectural replication of the Garden of Eden. So we discussed that last time, because this is the replacement garden, the replacement paradise where God dwells with his people. And so that's why you have pomegranates on these capitals on top of these bronze pillars. It's made to look like a garden paradise. So that's what you're going to see when you're walking up there. Their height is impressive. They got the pomegranates, and we're told in verse 21 that they have names. So one is called, I guess in English, how would we say this in English? Joaquin? I don't know. I was looking at it in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's Joaquin. Your J is pronounced like a Y. So Joaquin is the name of the first. And the other is named Boaz. Now, Joaquin, we might not be familiar with as a name. Boaz, of course, we all heard of.
Yeah.
Good old Boaz from the book of Ruth. And it is the same spelling in Hebrew. So Boaz is a personal name that we are familiar with. Joaquin, not so much. But what do they mean? Well, there's different kinds of ideas here as to how to put these two together. But Joaquin is from the verb kun, and we've actually seen this multiple times. So if you go back to 1 Kings 2, I think three or four times you have this verb occurring where God is establishing the kingdom of David or the kingdom of Solomon. So that's the verb. Kun is the verb there. So to establish is something that God does multiple times already in Solomon's reign. He establishes his throne. He establishes his kingdom. So when we get to this pillar is named from that same verb, and it means something like he establishes. So Joaquin means he, in reference to God, God establishes. So that's the first of these. And it's probably indicative of the fact that God is establishing the throne of David, or he's establishing his presence in Israel by means of this temple. The other one is called Boaz, and Boaz comes from the Hebrew word oz, which means strength. So Boaz would mean something like in him is strength, or strength in him, or something along those lines. So you got two pillars, and they both have names that have these meanings, but they're still names. Now, I don't know about you, Dan. What I find most interesting about the fact that they're named is not kind of the Hebrew meaning of the names, but the fact that we have pillars with names. And then when you look elsewhere in the scriptures, the Bible talks about people being pillars. So if you go to Revelation chapter 3, verse 12, this is Christ speaking. And he says, "The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God." So Christ is picking up on the imagery of the Old Testament temple, which had two pillars with names, Jachin and Boaz. And Christ is saying to us that the one who is in him, the one who conquers in him, is going to be like a pillar in the temple of his Father, which of course is the kind of the image of the church. So Christ is picking up on the temple imagery, the pillar imagery, to talk about individual Christians also being pillars in the church, pillars in the temple of God.
It's pretty common back in the temple building days, back when these sort of structures happened, when everything that was big had pillars. It wasn't uncommon at all for pillars to look like people. There's examples of this all over. I mean, Rome did this sort of stuff all the time as well. I mean, this went on for a long time. So saying that you would make somebody a pillar isn't weird. In a time when you had temples and coliseums and this sort of stuff, that was a way to sort of honor someone or enshrine someone that was very important. Or you're basically saying that we're going to build structures on the shoulders of this giant, right? And so this was a pretty common thing to do.
Yeah, and then in Galatians where Paul echoes the same language when he goes and he visits the three pillars of the church there, talking about Peter, James, and John, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, this is kind of a common idea that you have in the rest of the scriptures too. So to have these pillars named after guys is a foreshadowing of what's going to be happening in the life of the church. So that's the pillars. That ends the section with verse 22. Now, 23 is going to shift away from the pillars to talking about this famous, usually called the Bronze Sea. So verse 23 says, "Then he made," that's still talking about Hiram here, "then he made the sea of cast metal." And this thing was a monstrosity. I was trying to come up with an image that we might be more familiar with that would actually kind of fit with the immensity of this thing. So this Bronze Sea is immense. It holds 12,000 gallons. So at the end of 26, it says it's 2,000 baths. So that's about 12,000 gallons. I'm just kind of come up an image from like that we might be familiar with as to how big this was, like a backyard pool, swimming pool or something like that. But the Bronze Sea is intended to be this reservoir of water, but it's more than that. First of all, the very name itself is suggestive. And I was trying to come up with all of the symbolism that might be suggested by the Bronze Sea. And it's kind of hard to know where to stop. To begin with, in the Hebrew mind, the Yam, which is the word for sea, the sea is symbolic of the Gentile world. We see that all over the place. So you've got this Bronze Sea that is full of all this water, an immense amount of water, and the sea itself, in the biblical mind, is represented by the Gentile world. But in this case, the sea is upheld by 12 oxen. So verse 25 tells us the Bronze Sea stood on 12 oxen, three facing north, three west, three south, three east. Now 12, we associate with the 12 tribes of Israel. So at least it seems to me, and of course we're dealing with symbolism here, so there always has to be a little bit of a, you know, a question as to whether this is accurate, but it seems to me that what's being suggested is that you have the 12 oxen representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and they bear up, as it were, the Gentile world, which is symbolized by the Bronze Sea. So it's this idea that God, through Israel, is using his chosen people as the ones who are, as it were, bearing up the rest of the world, because it will be through Israel that all the promises that he gave are going to spread to the rest of the world. That's at least one interpretation. The other idea here is that the sea was iconic of confusion and chaos and disorder, and God has, as it were, brought the water into order. He's brought order out of the chaos by enclosing it within this Bronze Sea. That's another way to see this. Either way, the water itself also served a practical purpose. It had its symbolism, but it was also a practical purpose, because there was a need to use the water for washing, for cleaning up, and so it acted, practically speaking, as this place from which the smaller basins that we'll get to in just a second were filled. So you had the vast Bronze Sea held up by these 12 oxen, and then you also had, verse 27, 10 individual stands of bronze. Now this is all analogous to, but different from, what we had at the tabernacle. So if you go back to the tabernacle, you had a wash basin, but it was small. It wasn't, of course, anything like this Bronze Sea. For one thing, they had to transport it everywhere they went, so it was a lot smaller. But it was there between the altar and the tabernacle, in order that the priests could wash their hands and their feet in it. So what's happening now is you have this huge Bronze Sea full of all this water, but then you also have these smaller stands of bronze that are presumably filled from the Bronze Sea, and then these are going to serve the more practical purpose of being the place where priests can wash sacrifices, wash their hands and their feet. And then these were stationed on the north and south side of the temple. It's, you almost get the image here of these bronze basins lined up, each one filled from the Bronze Sea, and they're almost like a gauntlet. Like, you got some over here, you got some over there, on the north side of the temple, on the south side of the temple. And as I'm reading this, I'm almost getting the image of, so you, when you're approaching the temple, you're as it were walking between these places of water that are filled from the reservoir called the Bronze Sea. So it's sort of an Exodus image. They walk between the walls of water to cross the Red Sea, and now you're walking with basins over here and basins over there that are filled from this vast sea. So there's a possibility of an Exodus motif there.
Well, and here's what's interesting about this is that we don't have, you know, God giving these, you know, specific instructions to make all of this stuff this way, right? So, you know, the tabernacle, he gave pretty specific instructions on how to do this. One of the reasons that this is different is that we don't know that he has like specific instructions from God. He's following some blueprint, you know, that dropped out of heaven or whatever. As you get the details of it, it does sound pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Because one of the main ways this is different from the tabernacle, if you go back and you read Exodus, you know that it's almost like you hear all the stuff twice. So God says to Moses, make this way. He goes through all, he gives like the whole blueprint. And then we're told Moses did that, and then it goes through the whole blueprint again. That's not what's happening here in the temple. I mean, we haven't kind of been jumping back and forth between Kings and Chronicles on purpose. But if you go to Chronicles, we're told that God gave to David the blueprint, as it were, to how this is supposed to look. But we're not told what that was. You can't go to Chronicles and read the equivalent of... Right. of what happens in the book of Exodus. So, you know, I'm assuming that there was some creative leeway here for Solomon and for Hiram to do what they did. So, yeah, I mean, they're doing this on purpose. They're adding all the symbolism on purpose because they don't want it just to look pretty. In other words, they're not like, you know, well, I think if we had some oxen holding up the sea, that would be really neat. So let's just do that.
Right.
There's never a simply a motivation that something is going to be pretty for doing this. There's always a symbol behind that. And so anyway, like the 12 oxen, it's pretty hard not to connect that with the 12 tribes of Israel.
Yeah, because you don't know how explicit any of these instructions are. I mean, it could be as simple as, and the temple is to be surrounded by water. And then yeah. Solomon is like, how are we going to do that in like the coolest way ever?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how are we going to wrap all this symbolism in that? You just don't know. I mean, it seems unlikely that it was like, I need this much water here and this much over like that. That it probably wasn't that detailed. And Solomon is like, we're going to have a lot of water up in this basin and we're going to have it flow down to these, and we're going to have the sea up here and then we're going to have the flow down to these basins. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty cool. You know, and it matches so well with what we know from the temple's connections to other parts of Scripture. The Eden, for instance, is described as a well-watered garden. So, right. you know, there was water everywhere. Well, of course, this is the replacement Garden of Eden, so there needs to be water everywhere. And there was. I mean, all these gallons in the sea and then all the wash basins, yeah, there was plenty of water. This was not a desert garden. It was like an oasis. There was water everywhere. And then, you know, all the other kind of connections with the sea and whatnot. And then you go to the book of Ezekiel, and you got the famous vision of the river of the water of life that comes from where? Well, from the house of the Lord. So it flows from the house. And then, of course, this is the river that goes down and desalinates the salt sea. There's trees of life on either side of it. So Ezekiel, too, sees the temple in connection with water. So it makes sense that if you want to convey that symbolically, then you need to have a whole lot of water. So you got all these wash basins, you got the Bronze Sea, there's water everywhere at the temple.
Yeah, and of course it's hard to talk about all this and be like, well, what is the connection between all this water and the sort of life of the people of God, right? So the worship life of the people of God, it seems like water has a lot to do with this. Obviously, you have the initial connection to the crossing of the Red Sea, which is, you know, a very identity-forming moment in the life of Israel that they never really move past that, right? And they shouldn't. This is a pivotal moment in how they identify themselves. And of course, as Christians, water is directly then associated with the life of the Christian because of baptism. And Jesus sort of comes along and says, all of this water that was always going on in the life of Israel, well, let me explain to you exactly what that's all sort of pointing to, which is, I'm going to use water to bring you from death to life and bring you out of darkness into light and out of rebellion to God into the household of God. And so it's hard to see why do you have the sea? Why do you have all these different ways? Why is that water surrounding everything? Well, as a baptized Christian, I think it becomes easier to see. I think I understand why you have to pass through all this water to get into the temple.
Yeah, water is one of those biblical themes that kind of ties everything together.
Yeah,
I mean you got water and you got water in Genesis 1 and 2. You got water in Revelation 21 and 22. Then you have all these water stories. You got water at the temple, and then yeah, well, why? Because it's all leading us really to baptism. Mm. It's all leading us to that water by which God the Father makes us one with His Son. I love it when churches, not all churches do this, of course, but some churches will put their, if they use one of the baptismal fonts, they'll put it either at the entrance to the church, or they'll put it, as it were, in the way, like when you're going up to the altar.
Yeah.
It's like purposely in the way. It's there to make sure that you realize that it's only by going through water that you come to God. So even the symbolism of some churches is set up to make sure you get the point. You get to God wet.
Yeah.
He baptizes you.
Yeah, our church is like that, where if you're going to go receive the Lord's Supper, you're going to have to pass by the font. And it is in the way. It splits. The people have to go on either side of it. Walk around it, you know?
Yeah, the same way our church is set up as well. Yeah, I love that kind of placement because it makes sure that water always remains front and center of our life. So the temple communicated that as well. Now we're at verse 40. And we're going to just hear about a few more details here about some of the other stuff that he made. He made some pots, he made some shovels, he made some basins. Presumably all of these were made out of bronze as well. And then we have this. Now listen to this verse. It's kind of easy to kind of just brush past this and not miss a connection that's being made. This is the second half of verse 40. So Hiram finished all the work that he did for King Solomon on the house of the Lord. What's happening in kind of between the lines there, really not in between the lines, it's just embedded within the text itself, is an echo. I think we are intended to hear an echo of Genesis 2:2. So Genesis 2:2 says, on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and then he rested on the Sabbath day. So this idea of God finishing the work that he had done, and now Hiram finished all the work that he did, is one more connection between what's happening in the temple and then what God did in creation. So just like Moses, along with Bezalel, were sort of creators, if you will, and I put that in air quotes, they're creators making this little bitty cosmic world of the tabernacle. So now Solomon, along with Hiram, are, again, quote, creators making this little cosmic world of the temple. And just like God finished his work, now Hiram finishes his work on this ongoing place where God dwells with his people. And then the rest of those verses describe just more of the details of the stuff that he made. Get to verse 45, we hear about the pots, the shovels, the basins, all these vessels that he made were of bronze, and we're told where this took place. He didn't do this in Jerusalem. He worked on the plain of the Jordan. That's where he made his casts, and I guess it was clay ground in the plain of the Jordan that he used. And then after they were made, they were transported to Jerusalem. So the work of Hiram is finished. Everything that he made out of bronze is described. Now notice the transition that takes place. So we're at verse 48 now. We've heard about all this stuff, everything from the big bronze sea to the little bitty shovels that Hiram made out of bronze. All that stuff was used outside the temple proper. So you got the temple building, and then you have all the stuff around it in the court. All that stuff in the court was made out of bronze. Hiram did that. Then verse 48 says, Solomon made all the vessels that were in the house of the Lord, the golden altar, the golden table for the bread of the presence, the lampstands of pure gold, and then it goes on to describe the rest of those. And then verse 51 echoes what was said earlier about Hiram. Thus, all the work that King Solomon did on the house of the Lord was finished. So here's what's happening. In the temple, you have the gradations of holiness that we've talked about multiple times, where, of course, the Holy of Holies is the epicenter of holiness, and then you have the holy place, and then you have the holy court, holy city, holy land. And the farther out you get, the less holy things are. So that's obvious just from the way things are named. But you also have gradations of holiness that are connected with the stuff that's in these places. So if you're in the holiest place, the holiest area, which is the temple itself, everything in there is made out of gold. And there's even a different Hebrew word that's used for the craftsmanship of like the curtains that are within this holiest place. So that particular place is most holy, and so the materials that are used in it have to be also the highest quality. So in the Holy of Holies, you couldn't have bronze. You got to have gold. Now, Solomon, we're told, is the one who did all the golden stuff. So Solomon's the Israelite king, And so he does all the gold, and the gold is connected with the holiest place in the temple. So all of these adhere together because they're the highest gradation of holiness, as it were. So you can't have, in other words, you can't have Hiram, who is half Israelite, half Tyrian, doing the stuff with the gold, because that's reserved for the king of Israel. That makes sense?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's fascinating to me that all of these details are reflective of the whole structure of the temple itself. So you got the court that's connected with Hiram and bronze. And Hiram himself is part Israelite, part Gentile. Now, what is the court? The court itself is the picture of the world. Like the sea is part of the world, and you got water as part of the world, and all the elements that are part of this court, which is symbolic of the world, are made by Hiram, who himself is half Gentile, half Israelite. So the Israelites share this court, the outermost part of the temple, with the Gentile world. And so the guy who makes all of the stuff that's in there is himself part Israelite, part Gentile. So even the artisan who's involved in this is something which fits with the symbolism of the temple.
I like verse 47, where it says that Solomon left all the vessels unweighed, talking about these vessels of bronze, because there were so many of them that the yes. bronze, the weight of the bronze was not ascertained. And if you're reading through this, there's a lot of bronze stuff on the outside of this thing. I mean, a lot. You might have picked this up as we've gone through stuff, but weighing stuff is like a really popular thing to do. They really want to know like how much stuff weighs and how many gallons of this and the thing there is and how long this thing is. This dude's making so much bronze stuff that even Solomon, who is like, we're not weighing all that.
Yeah, even Solomon, master of details, right? He's like, nope, ain't happening.
Way too much bronze things to weigh. We're not weighing all the stuff.
Yeah, it is kind of ironic in this chapter, which is like super detailed. I mean, down to like how many pomegranates per cubit are you going to have on this? And then finally, you get down to like, how much did all this bronze stuff weigh? Solomon's like, we're not even going to find out.
Yeah. It's weird. It's a kind of an anomaly in the scriptures for them to make a reference to not knowing how much something weighed because there was so much of it.
Yeah, I guess that it underscores the fact that this was so immense. There was so much bronze out there that it seemed just vain to try and figure out how much all this weighed.
Yes.
Okay, so that takes us through pretty much the end of the chapter. If you're looking in your Bible, you'll see that there's reference in 48 and 49 to some of the interior furnishings. You've got this the golden altar, the golden table, the golden lampstands, and the tongs. When I saw the tongs referenced, it my mind jumped immediately to Isaiah 6, when you have the great vision of the prophet, who's possibly, you know, some people say Isaiah was a priest as well, which is, you know, is entirely possible, but prophet, priest. And he sees this great vision of the seraphim, and they're chanting, Kadosh, 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 holy, holy, holy. And he says, woe is me, for I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And one of the angels takes tongs and gets a coal from the altar and then touches his lips and says, you know, you're clean. The coal has purged you. So just the idea that these utensils, one of which was tongs, was then used by an angel to cleanse the mouth of the prophet in this famous vision is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, all right, so chapter wraps up with saying King Solomon finished all this work in the house of the Lord. That's another echo back to that Genesis 2:2 verse that we referred to a few minutes ago. And then it wraps up by saying Solomon brought in the things that David, his father, had dedicated, the silver, the gold, and the vessels and stored them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. So Solomon's wrapping up everything that, of course, David had wanted to do. David wanted to build a temple. God says, no, I'm going to build a house for you, but your son will come along and will do this. And of course, this is exactly what Solomon has been doing. And this is a major signpost, if you will, along the journey from creation to redemption, because the temple looms so large, and we're not even done with it. I mean, we have to get to, they're bringing the ark in chapter 8, and we have Solomon's long prayer, all the sacrifices. So much time is being spent on this because this is just a huge moment in Israel's history. It's a huge moment in salvation history, because creation is being redone in a sense, because this is the new Garden of Eden. The Exodus, as we talked about before, is now being brought to its fulfillment because God has now established his house on this holy mountain, just like the Israelites sang about back in Exodus 15. And now that we have the temple, now that we have King Solomon, now that we have all this stuff happening in Zion, we have this portrait ahead of time of so much of the work of the Messiah. I mean, everything he's going to do in Jerusalem, the fact that his body is the replacement temple that he's going to rebuild in his resurrection, the fact that he's going to be the ultimate sacrifice that is going to be offered that will bring to an end all of the sacrifices at the temple, and that he's going to be the one who establishes the new temple, which is the church, with human pillars, as we discussed a few minutes ago. So it's hard to overestimate just how important these chapters are for the bigger story of Scripture. So much comes to a head here that is then going to come to a head in the ministry of Christ.
Yeah, you can't read the rest of the Bible, honestly, from this point forward without the temple playing a role. I mean, whether that's the temple being destroyed and the temple being rebuilt, or the Jesus coming along and life, you know, and doing all kinds of things at the temple, right? I mean, the temple is, once it's there, it is central until, this is the reason, I mean, when Jesus says things like, I'm going to destroy the temple and then rebuild it in 3 days. I mean, you just heard what this temple looks like and how the process of that. I mean, like, you know, what kind of a outrageous statement that would be, and like why that would hit people in a way that they didn't like too much.
Yeah. And the fact that the temple becomes over time, in fact, doesn't take very long, but the temple becomes a place where people think that they're safe. Because, mm-hmm. We have a temple, so God's happy with us. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah will preach about this as well. So the temple becomes also, while it's intended to be a symbol of the presence of God and his holiness, in a sadly ironic sort of way, it becomes really the bastion of iniquity, as you see in Ezekiel, because Ezekiel will see all sorts of idolatry taking place there, and God will withdraw his presence from the temple. So it's one of these, it's kind of a catch-22. I mean, it's a beautiful place. It's where God dwells with his people. And then at the same time, it becomes an ugly place where sin dwells in the midst of God's people. And then he departs. And all of that together is really one more way that God is preparing people for the necessity of Christ, the temple, to come to take care of the needs of humanity.
Well, this is why when Solomon was set out to build the temple, when God doesn't say a word about the temple, instead he talks about fidelity and worship, because if you're asking the question, can you make an idol out of a house for God? The answer is yes, you can.
Yes, you can. It's happened many times.
All right. Well, we'll leave it right there. And next week we will get into getting back to the ark. It's been a little while since we talked about the ark. And so we'll get to do that next week. I'll see you then.
All right. See you then.